listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
With the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have comedian and writer Carl Kozlowski. How are you, Carl?
Great, great. Thanks for having me, Nikki. And, you know, it's been a long time, but you're looking great, sounding great. Looking forward to it.
Likewise. And you know what? A lot of people don't know, but Carl is the reason I started my radio show. I was a guest on Radio Titans many, many moons ago. And then you asked me to host my own show. And I was like, man, I would love to do it, but I don't want to just do musicians. I want it to be open to everything. And you were super supportive. And it was a lot of fun. We started in downtown LA. And I thank you for that opportunity, man. I never got to thank you on camera, but here it is. Here's the sign of gratitude. Thank you so much for giving me that opportunity, because this is taking on a new life. And I've been able to kind of like leverage it into some really cool opportunities to meet some great people like yourself. So thank you so much, Carl.
Well, hey, you're welcome, man. And, you know, we also, me and my original partners for podcasting, we started at LA Talk Radio. And, you know, we had a really good time there as well. So
that's awesome. Thanks
to Sam, yeah.
Well, so let's go way back. Where did you grow up, and kind of how did you get way into comedy and writing? What was the moment of Zen that made you want to be a comedian?
All right. Well, okay. So I was born near San Diego, and we lived in Chicago from like age 2 to 6 for me. And okay. Then we moved to North Little Rock, Arkansas. And my dad was a doctor in the VA system. And Arkansas was basically the first job offer that he got. Because you know, he had to relearn medicine in America. He was from Poland, because wow. You know, he had to, you know, if you're a foreign born or speak a foreign language, you have to restudy it in English and probably any country wherever you move to, if it's a different language than you, just to make sure you better know it inside out.
Right.
So don't mess up the, you know, you can mess anything up. So he was training in Arkansas after a couple of years in Chicago. And the first job offer that came, or we were in Chicago for the training. First job offer comes along, he jumps on it, and he really knew nothing about Little Rock. And so he was like, I don't know. So, but he was excited, but it turns out they only showed him the best parts of Little Rock for like 2 days as a way of luring him. And then once we got here, he was like, what have we got ourselves into? But, you know, they've been there like over 40 years. You know, my folks live in the same house that we've had since like 8.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. And your dad, you said your dad, did he grow up in Poland?
Yeah, he was born and raised in Poland. And he moved here when he was 29.
Wow.
And, yeah. And my parents had already been married. Like, they got married at 29, and then it took him 2 years to get to come to America, because he had 2 years of red tape under the communist regime before
wow.
he was allowed to leave for America. But as far as comedy, I'll try to get this quick. I don't want to just drone
on. No. I like stories. So, like, give me your life story. We're going to try and get this, you know, get it all in.
Okay. And by the way, I have Asperger's syndrome, form of autism. That's why I squint or look away sometimes. I apologize, folks.
No worries. It's all right.
Okay. So anyway, so we're here in Little Rock, and I wasn't really into comedy as a little kid. I didn't pay attention. You know, I don't know how many people have their favorite thing in mind by the time they're 6, right?
Right.
But when I was 12, or 11 or 12, I finally stumbled across, oh, sorry, when I was 9, I remember this. I was homesick one day, and there was this hilarious talk show in the morning, like right after the Today Show kind of thing. And it was a guy named David Letterman, and he had a morning show. This is like 1980.
Oh, I didn't know this. This is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And so basically he had this show for about 3 months. He was too weird for daytime, and NBC canceled him, and he was lucky that somebody at NBC said, well, let's try him in the middle of the night. What can it hurt after the Tonight Show? Nobody's watching. And so they gave him the show then. And so I liked that show so much the first time at age 9 that I made myself play sick about every 3 weeks or so, just so I could fake it and stay home so I could watch that guy. And
how was his morning show different than his late show?
Wasn't that much different. It was just, you know, but he was having to be like fake being sunny and happy instead of like letting his sarcasm show through as much. But you could tell, I mean, I was 9 years old and you could tell this guy's faking it completely. And so I just remember I loved that. And a couple years later, he gets on Late Night with his own show. And I started but after a couple months, I was basically the only kid in the seventh grade with bags under their eyes, because I would like set an alarm in my room every night to wake up, jump out of bed, sneak watch the Letterman show, and then go back to bed. And awesome. I was just addicted. I never felt, you know, fell out of love with comedy ever since.
Well, and he had such great monologues in those early days. They were so good. They were risque.
Oh, yeah.
They were just like crass and just kind of off the wall, because he was trying to compete with Carson, who was kind of like super sharp and super just like almost Disney. You know, he was like much cleaner version. So that's awesome. So Letterman was your first major influence.
Yeah. And I mean, and still, you know, all these years later, I'll just say I'm 51. I hate to say, and that started, my obsession started when I was 9.
Wow.
And the thing is, I should have sent you a video of this, man. I'll just tell people, if you go to TikTok, look up my account. I don't do it anymore. I did it for about a year. It's called That Funny Walmart Guy. And what it was I worked in a Walmart, and my dream had been, since I was a little kid, one of my so big life dream was to get on a bullhorn and say ridiculous things in public just to drive people crazy, because David Letterman did that a lot in the 80s.
That's awesome.
So I got this job at Walmart, and you know, I thought, oh, I've hit bottom. This is horrible. I'm not doing it anymore. Thank God I got a better job. But I was like, this is totally terrible. But after a couple months, I convinced one manager, let me get on the microphone one night for the closing store announcements. And he thought I was just going to give the same boring announcements that they always give. Instead, I did something really smart-ass and off the wall. And people were laughing. You could hear it in the whole store. People were stopping and laughing. Workers, customers, everything. And the next day, I got word from the top manager that it was my job now, every night, to do the announcements at the store.
That's funny.
And I could do whatever I wanted as long as I didn't swear. And I mean, I literally said some off the wall risque things sometimes, but I always
remember any of the things that you used to say.
I remember things like they were usually like saying, you know, hey, I would say whatever wacky holiday it was, look up on Google, because every day's got like a International Mustard Seed Day or whatever.
Right.
And you know, so anyway, so I would call out the day of the honorable day of the day, and then I would say something ridiculous about the kind of food it was or whatever. Or eventually, the last 3 or 4 months is when I really hit my stride. I started using jokes or telling stories. It was a good skill. I need to apply it here better. But I was telling stories, like my funniest stories, like from the book that are in there, for less than a minute. And so I was getting a huge audience, and I finally told a story about Bill Clinton and how I served him popcorn once when I was a teenager and how I felt sexually harassed by him. Because I was in a movie theater. I'll just tell you guys this because it's pretty funny. I was in a movie theater, and this is like senior year of high school, and Governor Clinton at the time, he comes walking in, orders some popcorn, and I said, "So what size would you like?" And he goes, "I'll have popcorn and a Coke, please." And I was like, "Oh, okay, so would you like butter on that?" And he's like, "Come on, man." And so I said, "Well, what size do you want?" He goes, "I want jumbo, of course." And don't you know me at all? So I was like, "Okay." So I take the jumbo popcorn, fill it up, slide it under the butter machine, and I give it three squirts of butter, which is like the legal limit. I slide it back over to him. He looks at it. He slides it back to me. And he says, "Come on, man. I want you to hit it. I'll tell you to stop." I swear to God, all true. And I said, so I give it like five more squirts of butter, which is like, or five, you know, three times the, you know, recommended health limit in the state. And, you know, basically, I felt sexually harassed. Yeah, and I don't think that was the last time you ever said that to anyone. So, but I told that story on TikTok, and it went viral. It was the first viral thing I ever did, I think. And it went, it got 755,000 views.
Wow.
And then I'm friends with a local media legend here. It was a radio DJ turned TV anchorman named Craig O'Neill. And he's very good friends with Bill. He's like first degree friends out of first, you know, 6 degrees of separation. And I sent it to him. He exploded laughing. He sent it, or his second degree friend, I'd say, he can get him on the phone anytime, but he has to go through somebody. He sent it to that guy who he has to go through. That guy started laughing, and he goes, "All right, I'm sending this to Bill." And so I've heard secondhand that Bill watched it and busted out laughing. So,
that's amazing. That's crazy.
Yeah, thanks.
So then when did you move from Little Rock to Los Angeles?
Okay, I went to college at Texas Christian University because they gave me a scholarship to get out of the state. And this does tie in completely with what you're asking me, don't worry. And while I was there, they actually had a really good TV department, and they had a TV talk show that actually aired on a real Dallas area station that was carried on cable like in 42 states or something. And of course, you know, hardly anybody probably watched. We were Sunday nights at 11. But to imagine when I'm a freshman getting to be on the writing staff of a show that was hitting 42 states was right. Crazy. And so I really got to put my love for comedy to use for the first time. And there was also a stand-up contest at TCU every year. And I came in second 1 year, and I won the second year. And then for some reason, they stopped having it. But I did really well at all those. And so after I graduated, I went to Chicago to study at Second City, which is the legendary improv school.
That's Bill Murray. That's Harold Ramis.
Chris Farley. All these guys. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. So I went to the school there and learned improv. But I was terrible at improv because it's a different kind of thinking than stand-up. Because you're thinking about, you're with a group, you're constantly having to think what the other people are saying, you anticipate, et cetera. And in stand-up, you just do it yourself, and you were in total control of your situation. So I was not comfortable doing improv, and I was about to pack up and go home after like 2 months. But then a friend said, "Don't do that, man. You can't give up after 2 months." I said, "Why don't you go do stand-up at this bar?" And I was like, "Oh, I did that a couple of times. That was pretty good." So I went, and I got one big laugh from one woman that night, and that kept me going for another 6 months. Wow. I sucked for the first 6 months, but I got one big laugh, and that I kept going. Well, I made her laugh, and she was a regular comic, so I'd see her around, and she was cute, so I kept showing up just to try and get her to laugh again.
So she was there every day, every night or every other night?
She was, there was a, you know, at most of the scene. Yeah, it was like most nights of the week we were all out somewhere. Yeah.
Tell me about that transition from improv to stand-up, because those are both kind of like free art forms in a lot of ways. Like you're just kind of like on the spot in the moment. Tell me how it was a little bit different to do stand-up in comparison to improv.
Well, I mean, my problem is, okay, improv, a key thing, well, probably the most important thing is that you learn to just go with the flow so much that you're not worried about what the next people say. I mean, you still have to listen so that what you say to them and vice versa flows. It makes sense, but you're not supposed to obsess over it. And with stand-up, you're completely on your own. Nobody can mess with what you're saying. You sink or swim with your own material. And I've seen some comics say you're writing, you're directing, you're editing, you know, you're acting, because you're coming up with your whole act yourself. And so, like, I just was terrified of what other people were thinking in improv. Like, you know, I was just very self-conscious and basically just about gave up, you know, like I said, after a couple months. But with stand-up, you know, that when I started finally getting some laughs, you know, about 3 or 4 months in, it felt great. It was like just like pure adrenaline when you realize, oh my God, they're laughing at what I came up with. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. But I've got another story, if I may. This would be pretty wild. Okay. So the whole key to my whole life as a writer and a comic was that I had a meltdown on stage as a comic, even. About a year and a half into doing this, I was getting some decent like bar shows with people, you know, like independent shows that people do all over LA or wherever. But I still was nervous sometimes. And so this one night I was at the best independent show in Chicago and I was getting to perform. And I thought, for I don't know what reason, that I would put my notes on the other side of the stage and would try to just do the show myself. I mean, my performance myself without looking at notes. And back then we were all young and green and all that. And everybody had their notebooks up there. Even some people that have become well known. And like Kumail Nanjiani was in our crowd back then. And everybody would look at notes, but I stupidly put it like 10 feet away from me. So imagine I'm trying to tell my routine. And then a bunch of people were there to see me because I ran my mouth saying, oh, please come see me. And I was in a support group for I don't know what the word is, like a support group for anxiety and nerves and all that. And so my psychologist and my support group were there in the audience. Imagine, you know, I made it so much worse for myself. They even had them come see me. And I just lost my routine in my head. And I was running back and forth because even though I could have just grabbed my notes once and kept looking, I kept putting it down for some reason, running back to the microphone, forgetting the next thing, running over. And I finally just like freaked out so much. I ran off the stage, out the door, and I was going to quit. I didn't know, you know, I just completely didn't know what to do. And the next morning, a comic named David Spark, he calls me up and he goes, Carl, we got to talk. And so we go to breakfast and he says, Carl, you know, you're killing yourself doing this. Maybe this isn't for you. And I was like, well, I don't know. And he says, well, do you think you're one of the 50 best comics in Chicago? And it was a big scene. There was probably 50 comics or more. You know, at the time, mid-90s, in a second tier city in LA, probably a couple hundred comics. And I said, no, but maybe I'm 51st. And I was like, you know, looking back, I'm like, oh my God, what self-esteem I had, right?
Right.
And so he tells me, you need to see a psychiatrist if you're going to keep doing this. And I said, ha ha, yeah, check my head, right? And he goes, no, seriously. So he said, maybe they can help you figure it out. So I went, signed up for a cognitive behavioral therapist, And that's where they give you, a lot of therapists don't tell you what to do. This type tells you what to do, gives you assignments that if you do them, you're supposed to break through your problem in no time. And so he, so this guy said, Dr. Rousseau, he says, well, normally I would tell somebody, and he had a French accent, it was really something. And he goes, normally I would tell somebody who is terrified of crowds not to ever do anything in front of a crowd again. But he said, something tells me you're meant to do this. So I'm going to tell you, what is something that made you stand out from other comics that they can't do? And I said, well, when I was in college at TCU, I had a humor column in the school newspaper every week. And I was the only one who got to keep doing his column for all 8 semesters that I was there. They had, you know, student surveys, which writers they liked. And I was liked enough that they kept me all 4 years. And I said, but I don't think anybody will give a chance to somebody from the South in Chicago. He goes, nobody cares where you're from. You just got to write something. So he gave me an assignment to come up with a great idea for a story that would be funny. Then he said, bring him envelopes that were marked for the 2 weekly and 2 daily papers in Chicago. I had 2 weeks to write the story. And then the third week I had to give it to him along. And then he would put them in the envelopes, send them out, and we'd see if I got a result by the 4th week. So I came up with a wild story. I'm not going to keep droning on forever about it. I'm just going to say the result was that I came up with this wildly funny story. And I was, it was something where I went undercover volunteering for Clinton and Bob Dole's presidential campaigns and all the crazy things that happened behind the scenes. And I wound up getting a call. Like, I was thinking, oh, you know, it didn't work out. And I was all down about myself. Then I get this frantic phone call like 2 days before the election in 1996. And it was this guy on the phone going, are you Carl Kozlowski? And I was like, yeah, who's this? And I'm at a Dilbert job where I'm sitting with a tie on at a job that I hate where everybody yells at me. Right. And the guy was like, well, you know, who are you? And I go, what do you mean? He goes, I just read the funniest thing I've ever read. And if you're the guy that wrote it, we're making this the cover story this week. We literally stopped the presses. And I was like, what? He goes, yeah, it's election day. And you wrote this amazing story that's perfect for election day. So by Wednesday, 2 days later of him calling me, my name, because they put our names on the cover in big letters, my name was all over the city, thousands of copies. And it was prominently featured in, you know, these newspaper boxes. And suddenly every comic was like, how'd you do that? Oh my God, I want to do that. Can you show me? And so that immediately boosted my self-esteem, gave me something unique that I could do. And I wound up getting hired by that paper within a couple months. And they were funding me to do all sorts of other crazy misadventures. Like for the next 3 years, I worked for them. And a lot of the stories are in the book that I've got today.
Well, let's talk about that. You got a book that you just want to show it to the people. It's called Dozed and Confused.
Yeah.
It's you've been battling with narcolepsy for a while. And you've been doing comedy and writing, and you kind of put this all into one body of work. Tell me like a little bit about the inspiration behind this, and then we're going to play some stand-up clips.
Oh, well, you know, we need to note to people, I literally took a nap before this show, and you had to call and wake me up.
That's right.
Or 8:02. Amazing. Anyways, yeah, I'm largely over the problem now, but
apparently not.
Well, okay. Touche. Yeah, so those are confused. Like you said, I have narcolepsy, or basically what it was a combination of a bunch of other problems that led to a huge sleep disorder. But because I passed out almost all the time anywhere, I was basically like narcoleptic. I wasn't literally diagnosed narcoleptic. But everybody was like, oh my God, you're narcoleptic. And so it became easier to just joke about it and use that term. So that's why I say that. However, basically when I was let me think when this started happening. It was like in 2000. I was 29 years old, and suddenly, I don't know exactly how it started. It just started hitting me. I would literally pass out all the time with all sorts of situations. And I remember the weirdest thing was I was in Chicago living there still, and I went to the Modern Art Museum in Chicago for an overnight event that they had where people could be there overnight and look at the art as late as they wanted. And I go there with my girlfriend, and I'm standing there. I'm feeling kind of tired. I'm like, I don't know, man. You know, I think I need to sit down. And she's like, oh, come on. You're always sitting down. And so I'm standing in front of this modern art, some sort of sculpture thing. And it was glass, too. And I'm standing in front of it, and I'm staring at it. And I didn't realize that I literally fell asleep standing up. And there's a thing called cataplexy, where when you're standing up and you feel your body knows you're asleep, but it's trying to keep you from falling, it puts you into a state of paralysis, and your eyes could even be open, but you're asleep somehow inside. And that's what would hit me at my worst nights. And I was actually having a fit of cataplexy in the middle of this art museum, staring at this glass installation. And I wound up falling forward, and I would have shattered the whole damn thing, except the guard was nearby. He just grabs me by the shoulders, and he's like, buddy, you're out of here. And so they thought I was drunk or high, and they threw me out of the museum in front of the crowd of people. And, you know, that happened in a lot of places, not quite as dramatically, but I'd be in a restaurant or a bar, and I'd pass out, and they assumed it was alcohol. And it was just me, like, nodding out. You know, couldn't help it. But, you know, the worst case, though, was that when I moved to L.A. and I wind up having an episode while driving down the freeway. And I was lucky that it went from 70 miles per hour to a standstill traffic jam. And I wound up falling asleep. I rolled into the back of a pickup truck in front of me, and then I startled awake, and for some stupid reason, I floored it because I was so disoriented, and I wound up just turning my car into an accordion in the Wow. back of this guy's pickup truck, and they wound up, thank God I was okay because of the traffic jam, and I didn't hurt anybody, but my car was totaled, and when the cops came to ask what's going on, I admitted it. And the next thing I know, I didn't get to drive for like 18 years.
Wow.
And then I moved home to Arkansas in 2020, about 17 years after that car accident. And I finally met a doctor who was like, I know what to do about this. So all that time in LA, nobody could cure it. But I came here, and just partly because it was a slower pace of life, part of my problem was I was always amped up and running everywhere in LA, so that would make me exhausted, and I didn't know it. And here, I chilled out, and they solved the problem. And then, watch out, everybody, I drive again since March of last year. So, yeah, it's crazy.
That's crazy. Well, let's play a stand-up clip, and then we'll talk more about your book.
Okay, thanks.
All right, what do you want to play first?
Oh, man. You sent me these clips that I'd forgotten about, and I'm like, wow, they're actually pretty good. I would say just go ahead left to right in the order. I can't remember what the topics were.
We'll just play one. We'll play anyone. Sam, go ahead and play any clip.
I've been watching the career of Jake Gyllenhaal. I think he's got an interesting career going. Yeah, this guy actually played a Marine in Jarhead. Then he was one of the gay cowboys in Brokeback Mountain. His next movie, I swear to God, he's playing a cop. The way I figure it, all he has to do is play an American Indian and a construction worker. And he'll officially be the gayest actor ever. Let's see. So, yeah, I hate celebrities anyway. You know, it's like, you know, like Sheryl Crow. I mean, it's like, you know, all these stars. Everybody's sick of stars telling us, you know, how to live our lives and how to worry about global warming and how we need to be the ones who stop driving the limos. Like, you know, like they keep going. You know, Sheryl Crow, like, actually said, that everybody should use just one square of toilet paper when they go to the bathroom. Come on, folks. I mean, how do we know that she's even living like this? I say the proof is in the pudding, and the pudding is in her hand. Enjoy your mudslides. Oh, God. Let's see. Well, I'll tell you one last thing. I grew up in Arkansas. People always ask me if I met Clinton ever. I got to tell you, you know, I think that's kind of a silly question. It's like being from New Jersey and being asked if you knew Tony Soprano. But I actually did meet him once, though. I served him popcorn in a movie theater. Yeah, you know, he actually, came up, and this is a true story. He comes up to the counter. I said, "What can I get you, Governor?" This is back when he was still governor. He's like, "I'd like a popcorn and a Coke, please." And I'm like, "Oh, really? What size would you like?" He goes, "Come on, man, jumbo, of course." So I'm like, "Would you like butter on that?" And he's like, "Yes, please." So I give him, like, you know, our standard butter was like 5 squirts of butter for a jumbo. So I give it to him. I slide it back over the counter. He slides it back to me. He goes, "No, man, I want you to hit it till I tell you to stop." I have a feeling he told that to a lot of people over the years.
Very cool. I like those bits.
Thanks. That was fun, but unfortunately everybody had to hear the Clinton story twice. Sorry.
Oh, that's
about
all right. That's all right. And you lied. You said 3 pumps, not 5. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
I know you're right. You're right. It was 5 though. Yeah.
So let me ask you this. Like, when you're kind of writing, like, you know, stand up bits versus writing a book about comedy and a book about stories, how do you feel like the process is different from telling a joke to telling a whole story? Is it real estate, or is it? Do you have a little bit more time to kind of build into it with telling a story, writing?
Yeah. I mean, you definitely can stretch it out. I don't mean stretch out like, oh, bore people, but I mean, you have usually stories. A lot of these stories were up to 3,000 words, like 1,000 to 3,000 words, and when it's like 3,000 words, like an example was. I did a story where I dressed up as Santa and did 12 naughty things in a weekend across Chicago. And that's one of 3 Christmas stories in the book that are about disastrous Christmas events. And so anyway, great holiday gift promoting it that way. But yeah, I would, if I had lots of room, it meant that I could really plan what I was doing enough to, really think out, hey, what are some really funny things I can do? Versus in stand-up, it's like you're just thinking in the moment and you're right. Trying to get the short bits. You know, and some people are good at telling stories at stand-up, but most comics, it's just like punch, 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 punch. And, you know, so I like the writing more because I had lots of jokes in my stories, as you'll see in the book, but it was nicer to be able to try and tell an overall thing that gave it even more punch, you know, with the overall impact of it.
Very cool. And you said you were writing this during the pandemic. How long did it take you from start to finish to write the whole book?
Let's see. Well, initially I tried it like for about over like 2 or 3 month period at the start of the pandemic. But I didn't really have an idea like how to make it fly for some reason. So I put it away for a long time. And then this summer, I got a new job that I really like. It's boring, but I surprisingly like it. And it's a good paying job. And I was relaxed and happy. I work for Social Security now. And so my self-esteem was up having a real job that was going well. And so I thought, well, why don't I give this a shot? And so I went all pro and I hired somebody to design it, come up with the cover, you know, make the whole thing formatted right. I mean, it looks like a New Yorker magazine article. It's really well done. And I decided to put it out, you know, and I'm giving it as big a push as I can because I'm lucky. I worked in media for so long that I've got 25 years of contacts everywhere like you. And so I'm trying to get the word out and hit up everybody I ever knew who has a show or an article they can write or whatever. And it's been fun. I'm starting to see it snowball. So,
well, let's play another bit. We're going to talk more about this book. Here's Carl Kozlowski doing some stand-up.
excited about a lot of things lately. Especially the fact that I've lost about 50 pounds in the last 6 months. Yeah, thank you. I get that kind of applause when you tell people you gained 50 pounds in 6 months. Yeah. But I was supposed to lose 125 pounds, my doctor said. So I'm stuck in what I call the holy crap zone now. A lot of people have misconceptions about fat people. They think we're lazy. I'm a reverse anorexic. Yeah. So, you know, but people also, you know, like to call this a gut. I prefer to call it a spare tire. That way when my doctor tells me I'm morbidly obese, I tell him, hey, doc, I'm AAA approved and USDA prime cut, ladies. So, let's see. I'm also, life's going really well. I'm also narcoleptic. Officially diagnosed, that's the disease where you can fall asleep anytime. To be riding a bike everywhere. I'm not sure about the logic behind that one. It's like, I don't really know if I feel any entertaining for you folks to read. Kind of interesting because, you know, when I put on a suit sometimes, like for church or something or a wedding, and we get on the bike. Like, people get the hell out of my way because they think I'm the world's scariest Mormon. Yeah. So, also,
I like the Huffy joke, man. That was that made me chuckle. That's great.
Thanks, man. Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's so funny. You interviewed me a long time ago. I don't know if you remember this, but it's actually one of the interviews I've done. You know, when you do a lot of press, as I'm sure you know,
yeah,
a lot of interviews just blend into each other. Like you kind of
sure.
You remember some, you don't remember a lot of them. But there is one show that you had me on as a guest, and you had another guest that was supposed to be booked, or I think he was booked another time or something, and he walked in. And he was so pissed that he was booked or double booked at the same time with there were a couple other people. And you guys in the middle of the radio interview were having this like really hilarious argument. But it was like totally friendly. But it was just like you both were just having this moment and I was just stuck in the crossfire. I don't know if you remember that, but it was so funny because I was just sitting there holding my guitar like, whoa, this is crazy. It was so funny, man. It was so long ago, but it's one of those interviews and one of those moments where you're like, this is funny and it's cool because it's different. You know what I mean? It's like you don't expect things to go on like that during any kind of interview. But I remember that as being a funny moment.
Oh, God. Well, I don't remember that, but I'll tell you, we had one other incident like it when after doing Radio Titans in offices for about 4 or 5 years, I started doing it just from home. I wanted to scale back and whatever. So I did it with like five show hosts that I really liked. And they'd come over to my apartment for their shows. And one of them was an actress named Priscilla Barnes who had been on Three's Company. She was the replacement for Suzanne Summers. And so she had a show. And she brought in pretty interesting actors, a lot from her heyday in the 70s and 80s, as guests. Ed Asner was there once. And well, one time awesome. She goes, how do I get... how about if I get the cast of Three's Company, you know, the ones besides John Ritter that are alive, to come do an episode? And I was like, what? And so she pulls it off. And so imagine I had a doorman in my building, and there's everybody's hanging out in the lobby and stuff, and they're seeing one vaguely familiar face after another, you know, showing up. And they're starting to realize when they see Joyce DeWitt, like the buzz got out, like, oh, my God, it's Three's Company cast. And then Suzanne Summers showed up. It was insane. And they all show up an hour early. I told them, do not come before 4 o'clock. I had a 3 o'clock political talk show. And they showed up right before 3. and they're knock on the door. They literally come and knock on my door, like the theme song. And I'm like, oh my God, we're not supposed to be here. And they're like, oh, really? And they're kind of pissed because they don't understand that there's a show about to go on. And so I literally had to pull a John Ritter style Jack Tripper moment. I was running out between the hallway, begging the actors to leave, and then running inside of my apartment and begging the political people to leave. And they were going back and forth. And finally, I just was like, I swear to God, you'll get a month free to the political people if you just leave now. And, and so they left, and I wound up with this amazing experience of having them on the show.
You should have asked Mr. Furley and Mr. Roper, like, what you should do to kind of stall the time.
Exactly, yeah. But my landlord, he was laughing pretty hard about the whole thing.
That's so, funny. Yeah. Well, you know what? It's you know, this is no easy feat to write a book, to get it published. And I think, is it self-published? I believe it is.
Yeah, it's self-published, yeah.
That's not easy to do, and that's not easy to promote. And you know what? People, check it out. It's called Dozed and Confused. Carl Koslowski's Funny Stories, Dealing with Narcolepsy and Comedy. We're going to play one more clip, and then we're going to ask a couple more questions about this book, all right?
Thanks, yeah.
I'm stuck riding public transit a lot. Anybody else ever endure that in L.A.? I guess not. Nobody would applaud if they did, believe me. Yeah, you know, they call it the MTA here. I've come to realize that stands for Must Take Anyone. You know, and then they like have these ad campaigns on board the buses and trains trying to make it look cool. Like, they're like, take Metro to flirt. And they show like some attractive couple, like, you know, staring each other down on the train. I'm thinking, you know what? You know, I think that's ridiculous because, like, anybody who's ever ridden the Metro more than twice knows there's nobody that you'd want to, like, want to flirt with, including me. It's like, come on. One time I wound up on the number 2 bus on Sunset, and a drunk Mexican guy almost puked on me. That's the closest I ever want to get to exchanging bodily fluids with anybody on board the buses or trains. Yeah. Then they also have, like, the Take Metro to Shop ads. Yeah, they make it sound like it's so glamorous. They have some, you know, Paris Hilton-looking chick holding some gold bags on Rodeo Drive or something, you know? Yeah, I'm sure the first thing that Paris is thinking after spending $5,000 on a bag is, hey, where's the next bus? I think they need a more realistic photo. Like, they need to have a close-up of somebody's hand turning purple from holding 52 plastic bags from the 99-cent store. Take Metro to Shop. That's my reality. Let's see. Yeah, I had a rough childhood. I grew up in Arkansas, and I was raised Catholic. So that made me double homophobic and naive. Yeah. Yeah, you know, but I think it's just ridiculous that homophobia is out there. I mean, come on, some people act like they're more scared of gay people than they are of bees. I mean, come on, that's just ridiculous. I mean, sure, a gay guy might sting you, but at least they won't swarm. I'm not even sure what that means.
Tell me, Carl, how did you choose the stories you wanted to put in your book?
Well, yeah, I did put a lot of thought into it because there's so many different stories that I could tell. But I mean, I tried to think of like I had a great story where I infiltrated Scientology. I went undercover and I actually made it to this like crazy pitch meeting where they were basically trying to trick me out of my money, and I described it, and I was all these former Scientologists got attention all over the country because they were like, oh my God, no reporter's ever shown what the big trick is, you know, how they shake you down. And that was a wild story, but the thing was, I thought I had that part in the article. I totally remembered having it, but then I reread it. I'm like, wait, there's not this hilarious part where I'm getting shaken down. And the rest of it was good, but it was like just serious. So I left it out because I couldn't find that part. I don't know what happened. Like in general, if something was just, even if it was crazy, if it was just informative, I left it out. I wanted it to be things that would genuinely make people laugh.
That's awesome. And you know what? This is a time when people definitely need to laugh more. So I hope people, you know, check out your book. Where can people find your book and where can people find you?
Okay, well, you go to Amazon and you just type in the words Carl Dozed and it'll come up. and you can just go there and you can buy it either as a paperback or a Kindle. And I'm hoping by December 10th to also have an audiobook, but I'm not 100% certain if that's going to work out. But yeah, you can go, you can find me overall at carlkoz.com. That's CARLKOZ.com. And that links to a whole bunch of other stuff I've done. And so you can check out a sitcom pilot I made, check out a radio show I hosted on KRLA for a while. And yeah, it's a good place to find everything.
Well, awesome, Carl. Thanks again for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. I'm going to show your book one more time. The book is called Dozed and Confused. Pick it up on Amazon or any other retailer online. And Carl, thanks again. You started this radio show for me by giving me this opportunity. I never thought I'd ever do a show like this. We've been in our eighth or ninth year now.
Wow.
And, it started with you, man. So thank you so much for giving me that opportunity. I appreciate you so much.
Thank you.
I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and tell your parents I hope they have a wonderful Thanksgiving too. Okay?
Yes, sir. Thank you. You too.
All right. Stay awake, stay alive, and you know what? Keep on keeping on. On behalf of myself, Carl, and Sam, we'll see you guys next week. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you. Thanks so much for tuning in and sticking with us. We'll see you next time. Peace and love.
Thank you.
Listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Perula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.